Religious reformer Martin Luther wrote, "Next to theology, I give a place to music, for thereby all anger is forgotten, the devil is driven away, and melancholy and many tribulations and evil thoughts are expelled. It is the best solace for a desponding mind." Michael Hicks is professor of music at Brigham Young University and author of numerous books, articles, and scholarly papers, among which is his book, Mormonism and Music, A History. This book has received numerous awards, reviewed by many prestigious publications, and the work we'll be discussing today. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
For those listeners who may not be acquainted with you and your work, will you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Well, my paths are many. I'm thinking back just this week, going to a student of composition's recital and submitting a book manuscript yesterday to University of Illinois Press about an experimental music composer. Of course, I'm doing this and always end up talking about Mormon musical things. And I just finished as the editor of the journal American Music for University of Illinois Press. And so among composers, I might be known as a composer, and among musicologists, I might be known as a musicologist. And I guess I just either have a restless mind or some kind of scholarly ADD. I've gone in many different directions and seem to feel at home in at least many of them, if not all.
Very good. So this book, as we were discussing previous to starting this recording, has been around for more than 20 years.
It has been.
What was the impetus? Why did you write it?
Well, I went to school at University of Illinois, and of course, when you're there, you take an interest in the life of Mormonism in Illinois in earlier times. You visit Nauvoo and so forth. And so I began writing a few things, researching some things then. And it happened that the University of Illinois Press, long after I'd graduated, wrote me a letter. And they said, "We understand you're giving a paper," which I was, "at the Society for American Music, on Brigham Young as a musical entrepreneur." And they said, "Well, send us that paper because we might be kind of interested in that." And I wrote him back and I said, "Well, I know that your best-selling lines are the American music line and Mormon studies, so you really need a book on Mormon musical history." And they said, "Okay, send us a proposal," and that's where that started in 1985.
It does seem you can't have one without the other, Mormonism and music. Mm-hmm. And you began in chapter one of your book with the Martin Luther quote I mentioned, mm-hmm. and you used it to describe a certain time, the beginnings of music in the church. Tell us a little bit more about that time.
Well, now I have to say it has been a long time since I wrote the book, but I do have a general sense for it. I mean, I guess I should add that, I grew up the son of a Baptist railroad worker who was married to his second wife, who was a Presbyterian map maker, and I went to sort of holy roller churches when I was a teenager. So my religious musical background was diverse, as was that of the area in which Mormonism was born. And so there were lots of different opinions about music, and some people didn't believe in music at all, that felt that, as some had felt for centuries, that it was something too pleasurable and therefore diverting one's mind from more sacred and solemn topics. There were others that used it for worship, but only vocal music. There were others that allowed instruments in their congregations. And so it was in that that kind of context that the revelation directed towards Emma Smith, that we now know as Section 25, was pretty important. It said a lot, but it didn't say everything that we would need to know in time. Just to remind people of that, this was given, I believe, in July 1830. Emma Smith had not yet joined the church, which was organized officially in April of 1830. And here in that revelation, some incentives and directives were given to her about, in my opinion at least, reasons why she would be at home in the church and why she ought to join and the things that she would do. And she's told that it would be given to her to make a selection of hymns to be used in the church. And so that was definitely a confirmation. We're going to have hymn singing in this church, which was not a given. We might think so, but it was not necessarily the case that you'd be singing in church. And she was not necessarily told to make a hymn book, but she could make the selection of the hymns. And then there's this statement that the song of the righteous is a prayer unto me. And that's actually taking it a step further and saying, you know, the singing is not just an acceptable pleasure or a tolerable thing, as ancient Christian fathers might have said, but in fact, it was something that was pleasing to God. It was part, it was akin to prayer. So it was part of worship in that sense. It doesn't say anything about instrumental music, and that's a separate issue that comes about in different ways in the church. But to begin to sanction music in that way, at least when it comes to song, was a very important thing. And as I say, it was not a given or something that was commonly accepted in denominations and religious folks in that area of the country, certainly.
So this revelation came after the translation of the Book of Mormon. Mm-hmm. Did the Book of Mormon help shape any views on music in the early church?
Well, it's hard to say. There are some references in the Book of Mormon. There's some positive ones. It talks about singing with the choirs above and so forth. And we're told that we'll be able to sing redeeming love, which is an interesting phrase. And actually, there's a hymn. There are several hymns called Redeeming Love. And they talk in those hymns about singing redeeming love. So that was a common phrase that ends up appearing in the Book of Mormon. I think people would have recognized that sentiment. But you also have references to dancing and connected, as I recall, with the word rudeness. And so dancing, which is, you know, totally linked with music, obviously, it's not such a good thing. It isn't specifically condemned, but it seems to be associated with rude behavior.
And Laman of course, and Lemuel.
With not the most positive characters. So, yeah.
You mentioned instruments in the early days of the church and this time period. What was allowed? What wasn't?
My feeling is, and everything I've seen, is that there was no instrumental music in the church until it came in through the back door of the militias in the church. You know, you don't have in early Mormondom, early Mormon communities, a separation of church and state that we think of as sort of bedrock American thinking. And so, you know, the military was really part of the church. You had, of course, Lieutenant General Joseph Smith directing the Nauvoo Legion. And you have, obviously, I think most people recognize that the military is a great sponsor of music historically, to rally the troops, to console those who are grieving. All those things require music. And so you have in the early Mormon militia from Zion's camp and then in Nauvoo, the Nauvoo Legion, as I mentioned, you have fife and drum corps, and then you eventually get other instrumentalists involved. It's interesting, even the notion of a band, remember, essentially means any instrumentalists that could play. And fife and drum corps were playing by ear, but as converts begin to be made, particularly in Great Britain, and come to Nauvoo, they bring a literate tradition with them. They bring sheet music. They bring more sophisticated instruments. And as other converts join, particularly from the East Coast in this country, there's a musical literacy that creates a kind of new version of the Nauvoo Legion Band. And I've seen a roster of that band, and you've got such a mix of instruments. So you have trumpets, and you have other kinds of horns. You have a clarinet, and you have a violin in it, and you also have cymbals, which in the roster is spelled S-Y-M-B-O-L-S, which is sort of funny because that was the only kind of spelling they would think of, I suppose, for cymbals. But, you know, whoever they could get together, but this was a literate group. And you have the military group begin to play in ceremonies that are both civic and sacred. I mean, the dedication of the Masonic Hall, the dedication of the Nauvoo Temple, and so forth. And you have instrumental music being played by some of these musicians from the tower of the Nauvoo Temple. We read about after meetings finished in the grove down below it that slopes towards the Mississippi. So everything I see tells me that you have this group of military players, at least as you're not playing in church, but playing in Mormon militias. And then they begin to play in community, civic kinds of things that are kind of church things too. And then they're playing also in church meetings, first as prelude and postlude, but then eventually accompanying choirs and so forth. So I think that's how they came in. There was never any revelation saying, oh, yes, that we know of at least, saying, oh, yes, you can have instruments as part of your worship as well. And this was a problem because instruments were opposed by many religious folks in the United States at the time for maybe two reasons. One was a long-standing Christian historical opposition to instruments because they were man-made, and that God only wanted singing because man and woman were his instruments, in effect, that he would be playing. But it was somehow demeaning or less worshipful, at least, to play man-made instruments. So there was a bias against instruments for centuries from the earliest church fathers on. And there was also, in this country, a resistance to bringing instruments into church worship because it seemed too much like the old state churches of Europe, where there was this, you know, pomp and ceremony, which were both governmental and religious. And as you know, in this country, we wanted to keep those separate. Well, you know, in Mormonism, those lines blurred a lot. And even though there would have been a lot of resistance among many to the old type of use of instruments in worship, which reflected popishness, to use the word that sometimes got used, others saw this as really we're building a new nation, and it has a state church, and the church is the true church. And so I think that within the faith, people began to accept that. It's, you know, it's so tough to tell Latter-day Saints' reactions to so many things. You get glimpses in journals, and sometimes people would even leave the church over one thing or another, and we don't have a lot of records from those people. I was reading an account here just earlier today of a young woman who had joined the church. This is in the 1830s. And she had been quite the dancer. And that would have been sort of rejected on religious terms by most people. She'd stopped dancing, but she had to go get her husband from a pub one night. He was stuck there, and he was doing a dance, and she got up and danced, and another Mormon saw her, reported her to the authorities, and at that time, dancing was not accepted in the church. She was spoken to about it and left the church. And so there was still a lot of struggling about what was proper and what wasn't proper with respect to dance and even music. You have people talking about burning their fiddles as an act of repentance, and was that acceptable to play an instrument and not? And so there was a lot of controversy, at least in individuals' minds, and there's so many small congregations of the church, just so many branches bringing up. We don't have records to know what was really going on and how they felt about some of these issues.
We'll come back to dancing a little bit more in just a minute. But one of the chapters in your book is called Schooling the Tongue. Mm-hmm. From time to time in the Tabernacle Choir, we sing a John Rutter composition where he uses the writings of the Apostle Paul, which is, I will sing with the Spirit and I will sing with the understanding also. What did those words mean to early members of the church?
The words of Paul specifically?
Yes.
Well, I can only infer from what was probably understood at the time, outside of the LDS Church, because, at one time everyone was a convert to the LDS Church.
Right.
And the reference to singing with the Spirit, singing with the understanding also comes from 1 Corinthians 14, as you probably know. And Paul there has been talking, first of all, in 1 Corinthians 12, he talks about the gifts of the Spirit, and he mentions speaking in tongues. And then in chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, he starts off saying, though I speak with the tongue of men and angels even, and notice what he says. He says, if I have not charity, I am become as sounding brass and tinkling cymbals.
So instruments.
He's putting down the musical instruments, saying, if I don't have charity, even if I'm speaking in some sort of divinely inspired language, it's like playing an instrument, which is a pretty strong critique, and it tells you a lot about what was in their mind. But you get to chapter 14, and he talks about speaking in tongues and prophet, and that you should prophesy, that you should covet to prophesy rather than to speak in tongues, because speaking in tongues was a more showy thing, but prophesying was intelligible. But if you were to speak in tongues, and then he says pray, he talks about praying in the Spirit, which seems to be a reference to praying in tongues. And then he talks about singing in the Spirit or singing with the Spirit, and he contrasts that with the understanding. So that whole chapter is dealing with this, something that is mysterious, ecstatic in some way. Speaking in tongues, which we have lots and lots of references to in early church history, has really two meanings in the New Testament. First, you have the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, where the people come and are hearing the apostles after the Spirit has descended on them. They're all hearing them in their own language. And you also have this thing where people are in congregations, and this is what Paul seems to be talking about, are speaking in tongues. And this seems to be, again, it's hard to tell, but scholars usually feel that this is part of a long-standing tradition that you have even in other kinds of religions of ecstatic speaking, so speaking in unintelligible syllables. And apparently, according to Paul, this was a form of singing as well, that people would sing in tongues. Now, Paul was very adamant, if you speak in tongues or you sing in tongues, someone has to provide an interpretation. And he says in chapter 12, there's people have the gift of tongues and people have the gift of interpretation of tongues. And this is something that in the Protestant churches around Joseph Smith, and certainly in camp meetings, when I would read about it or hear about it in church history, is like, oh yeah, I know that tradition, because we would do that kind of thing all the time. You have that kind of thing on, and there's plenty of references to singing in tongues in the early church. and people who even had the gift of that. And I could read you some references, but it was critical that you also have this component of singing with the understanding. And Emma Smith says this in the preface to the first hymnal. She says the very first sentence, I don't know if you have read this, the very first sentence of the preface is, in order to sing by the Spirit and with the understanding, it is necessary that the Church of Latter-day Saints should have a collection of sacred hymns and so forth. And then at the end of this preface, she says, it's hoped that the following collection, selected with an eye single to His glory, may answer every purpose till more are composed or till we are blessed with a copious variety of the songs of Zion. And as I've studied this closely for many years, the blessed with a copious variety of the songs of Zion is referring to something that happened a fair amount in the early Latter-day Church, which is people would get up and sing in tongues, and someone would interpret what had been sung, and it would be written down, then versified, and that was considered a song of Zion. So it's not the more general sense that we think of songs of Zion now, but it had a particular meaning. And so when she says, you know, till more are composed, in other words, if someone works out this poetry, or we're blessed with a copious variety of the songs of Zion, I'm pretty sure that's what she was talking about, was this thing that happened. And sometimes, as I say, it would be in prose. We have this in the Kirtland Revelation book. There's a vision prophecy of, as I recall, of Enoch. And that very language, age after age has rolled away, something is how it starts. And then we find this poetry that is meant to be sung, published in the Evening in the Morning Star, the church newspaper, that is a versification of sections of that thing, which was sung in tongues and interpreted. That's what it says in the Kirtland Revelation book. So that, I think, is where we're in this realm of singing with the Spirit and singing with the understanding also. There were these episodes, sometimes in whole groups, of singing ecstatically, we might say, where the mouth, the tongue are sort of loosed from the cognitive processes. And it's a way of singing to God. And this is a phrase that I think Paul uses, is if you're speaking in tongues, you're speaking to God. Or you might say in a language that God only understands because it's coming straight from the heart. And you're in the Spirit, you're in a state of ecstasy. But Paul's saying, you know, it's better to actually do things that can be understood by those around you, to serve the community, serve the congregation. So he says, it's better that you pray that you can prophesy. In other words, speak in an understandable language so that you can edify people around you and not just yourself. So that's Paul's reference point, I would say.
Do you have any short examples of some of these songs of Zion, the lyrics spoken in tongues from the early church?
Yes, there's this one example that is attributed to Lucy Smith, Moroni's Lamentation. And as I recall, she was the interpreter of this that was sung in tongues. And sometimes the interpretations were just in a prose format and someone would go then and versify it or put it in a rhyming scheme. But sometimes it actually would come in a rhyming interpretation. I should add, too, that these episodes of singing in tongues sometimes were in completely, we'd say, improvised melodies. They were not any known tunes. And, you know, in my Pentecostal days, we'd all be singing in tongues. We'd all be singing in the same pentatonic scale. That would be like the black keys on the piano only. And as you might know, if you just play those, they all kind of harmonize together. You could sort of play them all together, and there's no half steps in there to create that kind of dissonance. So it always sounded great. But I didn't realize till later, and I had some musical training, oh, that's what that was. So that in a group context, we'd all be improvising tongues singing in that way. I think that's the kind of thing that happened in the church, in the early church a lot. But you also have references to people singing in an unknown tongue to a tune that was known. And I don't know what might have happened in this case, but this Moroni's Lamentation, of course, has a particular connection to the Book of Mormon. It's not just a general, you know, religious statement, but the interpretation that becomes this verse of hers says, "I have no home. Where shall I go? While here I'm left to weep below, my heart is pained, my friends are gone, and here I'm left on earth to mourn. I see my people lying around, all lifeless here upon the ground, young men and maidens in their gore, which does increase my sorrows more. My father looked upon this scene, and in his writings has made plain how every Nephite's heart did fear when he beheld his foes draw near. With axe and bow they fell upon our men and women, sparing none, and left them prostrate on the ground. Lo, here they now are, bleeding round." Thus sung the Son of Mormon when he gazed upon his Nephite men, and women too, which had been slain and left to molder on the plain. So very, very vivid, and in a way trying to, you read this even in hymns like "Oh Stop and Tell Me Red Man" is one of the early Mormon hymns, where the Latter-day Saints felt a real responsibility to give a voice to those people that they felt were people of Israel, descendants of Israel, who had so much been slaughtered and slain by the Gentiles, and that this new restored gospel was part of their redemption. And so there's lots of things that give tribute to or allude to those. Let me mention one other thing as well. This is from the Journal of Lorenzo Brown. And he says, "We were blessed spirit." He's describing this meeting, 1839. He says, "We were blessed spiritually with the gift of tongues, through which, and the interpretation, we learned many things. There were several hymns given, one of which was given through myself and interpreted by Sister Esther Crowley, who had the gift the most perfect of any person I ever knew. These lines I cannot withhold the impulse to subjoin, as I then thought and still think them good." And he writes down this verse that she gave as the interpretation to his tongue singing. Now, again, this kind of speaking in tongues is not like what we normally talk about and what we normally experience as speaking in tongues today, which is that there's a gift of learning a language rapidly or being understood even if by someone speaking a different language from your own native tongue, because the Spirit is enabling that communication. That's like the Acts 2 type of speaking in tongues, is what I would say. But this is a different kind of experience that had to do with a very almost primal sort of ecstatic response. And I think that we gradually over the many decades now since the church began, we've become more like Paul and said, you know, that's kind of neat, but really it's better to have things be intelligible and edify all through that and not these personal ecstatic episodes, you might say.
We're visiting with BYU Professor Michael Hicks today on Legacy. We're discussing his publication, Mormonism and Music, A History. So let's get back to dancing for a minute.
Okay.
You have a chapter entitled Going Forth in the Dance. Now, there's what appears to be a definite religious connotation in that phrase, going forth in the dance. Where did that term come from?
There's one place in particular where that phrase came from that I recall. This is from the Deseret News in 1859. And it's kind of interesting because it shows that this sort of queasy response to dancing, which was alternately approved and then sort of questioned and back and forth from I won't say the earliest days of the church, because all the evidence is that in the earliest days, dancing was condemned, as it was by virtually every faith. But here in this editorial, the Deseret News, it says, "Music and dancing has been more in vogue than during the same time last year. But if any particular good or benefit has accrued to the community or to those who have gone forth in the dance, the public have not been advised in the premises." So it's weird because they're using that seemingly biblical language, gone forth in the dance. And I think this relates to some earlier times when Brigham Young would encourage dancing for refreshment of the spirit, and certainly on the trail, part of it was to keep warm at night, because obviously the exercise itself, the circulation it gave. But Brigham Young, who we think of as approving many things and saying, if your heart is merry, you might want to dance, he still said, you've got to be able to do it with the Spirit. You've got to still have the Spirit with you. And this commentary in the Deseret News has that sort of intriguing flavor of making it a religious thing, because you could always cite David, the great king and prophet, dancing before the Lord with all his might, which even then was a source of some controversy, as you might recall. But still, this commentary goes on to say, well, we're not sure that this is really good, that there's been more dancing going on. So, yeah.
So another question then is, it seems like church leaders went back and forth over the years, decade in, decade out. Mm-hmm. Was it based on the actual dance or the leader himself, or what do you think?
Well, it did have a lot to do with the actual dance, because you had square dancing and line dancing, and then you had so-called round dancing, the waltz being the most notorious round dance. And again, these categories were throughout the certainly American Christian world. Round dancing, which was where you had one partner and you had your arms around each other, was really questionable morally. Should this be done? Now, square dancing, line dancing, where you're not that close and you're exchanging partners and it's more of a
Virginia Reel type stuff.
Yeah, it's almost more like a child's game in a way. But round dancing is sort of serious adult business. I remember someone even in our ward talking about dancing some years ago and saying, well, in my opinion, it's still the vertical expression of a horizontal desire. And so it has this strange aspect to it. Now, it's interesting because when I joined the church in the 1970s, the first year of my membership, we were all going to the Steak Dance Festival, and everybody was learning dances of various types and swing dances, and it certainly was not just line dancing or square dancing, but all kinds of dancing. And if you think about it now, Mormons are really thought highly of in the dancing world. They have a good reputation, whether you're thinking of shows like So You Think You Can Dance or similar competitions on TV where we often have finalists and winners, or you think about dance sport here at BYU. Somehow, dancing, once allowed in the church fully in some form or another, became almost integral to our identity. I think Mormons are known as a dancing people, and it's quite unusual in the non-Catholic Christian world, I would say, in this country, certainly.
There's a quote from Brigham Young in your book. Once in Deseret, dancing became more widely accepted, and Brigham feared it would actually become more than just a healthy pastime, and he warned that it should not be elevated to sacred rite. He said, when compared with the eternal realities of our holy religion, dance is like chaff to the sterling wheat. Mm-hmm. The one contains the essentials of life, the other comparatively worthless. Mm-hmm. And to reemphasize the comparison, he said, when we come to the things of God, I had rather not have them mixed up with amusement like a dish of succotash. So he wanted so to vivid. Keep it clear as to where dancing stood with things of...
Yeah, I think we still feel that, but... There's a striking statement from Joseph Smith in 1841 that is like putting a spade into so many prejudices and assumptions in the religious world of his time, at least the Christian world of his time. He says, what many people call sin is not sin. And,
wow.
And I think even though Joseph Smith, as far as I can tell, did not approve of dancing... We know that he had lots of enjoyments that were criticized, you know, from wrestling to lots of word play, word gaming sorts of things, pulling sticks. And there's even a story of one couple who had joined the church and came to visit him. I can't remember if this was in Kirtland or Nauvoo. I'm thinking it was in the earlier days, so in Kirtland. And they were very excited to meet the prophet. And they came to his door and were told that he was upstairs playing with children. And they left the church because they could not accept a prophet playing with children. And we just think that was so crazy now. But again, the idea with many was you have to have a certain demeanor. You have to be solemn and in a sort of, at least in a symbolic way, sort of in a robe all the time and a very long-faced. And even the thought that he would be playing with children was enough to send them out of the church. Well, you can imagine if he were dancing or... some of these other things that we know he did, these would really offend some people. But he himself doesn't seem to have taken part in dancing. There were actual dances held in the mansion house in Nauvoo. It seems like Emma was more at home with those. There's a reference by Heber C. Kimball, as I recall, where he says that when dances were held in his home, he stayed in his room, and that he said everything against it that he could. There was a later problem, and this had to do somewhat with the, how to put this, the division between the apostles and Emma Smith, which was very strong, and of course led to her staying behind in Nauvoo and they leaving, you know, for Utah without her. After the bodies of Joseph and Hiram had been,
laid in
state.
Laying
in state in the mansion house, there were then dances held later on. And there had even been some blood that had, according to Heber C. Kimball, dripped from the coffins there and still stained the floor. And when he found out that people were having dances on that, what he considered sacred space, it was just beyond notorious in his mind, because still dancing was not considered, as you've suggested, a sacred activity or somehow really sanctioned by God in the way that, you know, singing might be. Or even instrumental playing. Dancing still had that bit of carnality to it, you might say.
So despite all the church leaders' efforts, as you mentioned, dancing in this church took on a life of its own. There seemed to have been lots of schools and teaching all members how to dance better, maybe even to the detriment of learning
Well, it's hard to say how that happened. Like lots of things, it just the culture transforms and metamorphosizes over time,
right.
And if you know, it's tricky because I think of David O. McKay, who was the only prophet I recall who referred often to the two natures of man, the animal nature and the divine nature. And to use that term animal is interesting, not the sinful nature or the devilish nature or anything like that, but the animal nature and the divine nature. And, you know, these are both part of our nature, but he said the idea is to have always the divine reigning over the animal nature. But dancing is something that can be merely physical, but I think in his mind and in our minds collectively, as a kind of art, can take on a divine nature even in its creativity, if one thinks of that as the essence of our Heavenly Father, is that he's a creator. If dance is undertaken as part of our creative nature, we can move it from that merely animal to the divine. I think that's kind of what's happened without being said that directly or explicitly over time.
Another chapter you've called Homespun Music. We all know that...
homemade music.
Homemade.
Homemade
Thank
music.
You. We all know that Brother Brigham was big on self-sufficiency, mm-hmm. from fashion and farming to literacy.
Yeah.
And there were plenty of well-trained professionals in the area who came up with musical things, but the general membership of the church persisted in their homemade type music, mm-hmm. and lyric endeavors. Yeah. Tell us about some of those.
Of course, we have our hymn books, we know all that, and we have collations of folk songs that have been recorded over time. But if you get into the journals that and the diaries that people kept, you'll very often find lyrics written in the back of them that are original, and they would be commenting on their experiences, sort of the everyday experiences of the area in which they lived. Of course, people who were out in Mormon colonies would have some pretty abrasive lives sometimes, and any sort of pioneer has to encounter the mere act of survival, you know, that becomes the focus of their lives. And so the texts sometimes were about those sorts of things, the everyday occurrences, or just getting along, getting by. You also have homemade music that consists of rewriting familiar songs and putting Mormon lyrics to them, in effect. There's one that is, I won't say it's common, but there is a lot of this kind of sort of, a sort of mocking of the world and mocking of the Gentiles, if I can put it that way, because that's how they put it at the time. Let me go to this one. This is a Mormon lyric, very typical, where you take a solemn tune like God Save the King, in this case, or My Country 'Tis of Thee, we might also say. And this lyric, let mirth and jollity, joy and hilarity, bow at thy nod. When we engage to play as we do now this day, let not our spirits stray from thee, our God. And this, by the way, does speak to that issue of we always have to submit the impulses of recreation to worship in some way or another. And so this is part of that dedication. You know, it's so strange to many visitors here at BYU, where it's just habitual for us to begin every concert, really whatever it is, and any dance situation and so on, with a prayer. That seems so out of context or almost contradictory for many people, but it's something that's really been wired into us from early on, this notion of we've always got to, even though we're allowed to do certain things, we have to show that we are mentally and spiritually and in our souls acknowledging our submission to God all the time. Sometimes the lyrics are funnier than that, you might say.
In fact, spoofing.
Yeah.
I wrote one down here.
Yeah.
Called St. George and the Dragon.
Which
I guess is kind of commentary on their lives down here in the St. George area. I'll just read it. All tourists declare 'tis the land of desolation and marvel how white folks can live here and thrive. They know not how we starved while at work on half rations. 'Twas grit that kept body and soul just alive. The grub that we ate was in no way inviting, hard flapjacks of cane seed with boiled lucerne greens and burnt pungent treacle in which ants were fighting while flies buzzed by millions for lack of wire screens.
That's a great one. That's a great
Very telling eloquent, of the times.
Yes, yeah.
We're reviewing today on legacy topics from the book Mormonism and Music, A History by Michael Hicks. This is the Mormon Channel. You have a chapter entitled Mormon Classics. Who and what do you put in that category?
Well, this would be part of the quest for excellence and kind of looking at the kingdom of God and the Zion that we talk about from the beginning as the literate classical tradition of Western music. The stuff that we study and teach in our music history, music appreciation courses. And Latter-day Saints feeling that, you know, part of our destiny and our mission is to excel in these most eloquent kinds of artistic statements. You know, to take a sort of crude reference here, one of my favorite quotes by President Young, Brigham Young, is, "We can beat the world at any game." And this notion that anything that exists in the world that is good, we need to do it better. And so you have for generations, not just in music, but you have it in the visual arts and in language arts, this quest for so long in the church now to find an artistic voice that is really of a high and eloquent and learned and, as I say, literate tradition. So I'm not sure that I would say this work or that work is a Mormon classic, but even the notion of being a classic or pursuing classicism of some kind is the tradition that I explore in that chapter. We see it sometimes with the Tabernacle Choir in their performances of classic works, and of course there's a whole history of that. But I'm thinking more of the new works that have been written and as well as performed. Certainly the Book of Mormon Oratorio is one of the Mormon classics of the 20th century, where you have a highly trained, highly skilled, and award-winning composer writing this oratorio that's rooted completely in the Book of Mormon in its text, but in its musical vocabulary is rooted in lots of contemporary American idioms and so forth. And it's almost hard for me to speak of this because I'm in this field myself. I have classical students. I'm in a school of music degree program. I teach in the composition area. I have colleagues who at one time or another at this point were all students of mine. And we have this same kind of working together to write music at the highest level and the most eloquent level, and sometimes in vocabularies that are not very accessible or very approachable or much appreciated in some cases by large audiences and the unschooled. And so we like those mentioned in the that chapter, are sometimes branded with the charge of elitism of some kind, but we kind of feel that we're in this long tradition of really trying to stretch our imaginations. We go back to and we actually refer to sometimes in our discussions the statements of Joseph Smith, for example, the familiar one in the 1839 Liberty Jail letter, where he says, "Thy mind, O man, if thou wilt lead a soul into salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens and search into and contemplate the darkest abyss and the broad expanse of eternity." That kind of reaching and stretching is part of what we think of as cultivated art tradition. And when I'm talking about Mormon classics, I'm talking about those composers in particular, as well as performers, who really have tried to do that and to train themselves or be trained in the most eloquent, non-vernacular styles.
In both the preface and epilogue of your book, you make reference to Psalm 137, mm-hmm. verses 1 through 3, which I'll read here. Mm-hmm. "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps in the willows in the midst thereof, for there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of mirth, saying, Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" Tell me the significance of those verses with Mormonism and music.
Well, I have to think back on that now. You know, I might look at those verses a little differently now than when I wrote them and cited them in that book. There is that tradition of how does one deal with tragedy? And certainly in early Mormon history, there was a lot of tragedy. And it was difficult to know how to embrace music when you were dealing with, as I say, either survival or at least continuation of either the faith or the community, and on the trail, certainly, of individual lives. What I say towards the end is that now the question is, how can we sing a strange song in Zion? I think that's what I refer to in the epilogue to the book, which is to say, now we're constantly dealing with what is tolerable. What can we, now that we have a well-established and not to be denied solidarity of culture, what can we bring in? What can we embrace? What can we hear? What can we write that will be acceptable? We read scriptures about gathering things in creating Zion, and this notion of bringing all truth together. How far can we go? What kind of strangeness will become part of our divine destiny once it has been sort of amalgamated into this large kind of patchwork quilt, you might say, of Zion that is many voices and many cultures? We're always dealing with that. What can we accept that's new, and what do we have to resist because it's new? It's that old dichotomy that you find in Max Weber in The Sociology of Religion, the priestly versus the prophetic, the priestly saying, you know, we have to hold to the things that have always been there and the things that must be unchanging, versus the prophetic, which is exemplified in Christ saying, you've heard it said by them of old times such and such, but I say unto you this, and it's quite different. And it's difficult to hear, and the prophetic voice is questioning and wrestling with change and the need to change. Of course, repentance itself is change. So these two are always wrestling with each other, and certainly in our music at all levels, whether we're talking about music for dances or we're talking about music for concerts at BYU, and so many things now, particularly with the internet. What can we bring in and make part of Zion? What do we have to keep out, and so on? So that's what I see as the new sort of reverse form of that scripture. Not can we sing the songs of Zion in a strange land, but can we sing strange songs in Zion?
Do you have any favorite stories or people? Just quickly here to the end, we're just about out of time.
Any favorite stories or people in church musical history?
Sure, yes.
Well, this is a tough one for me because I actually wrote a postcard to my mom this morning. I said, I'm going to be on this radio show talking about Mormon musical history, of which I'm soon to become a part, apparently, because I think so much of people that I've known in the church and thinking of that now as history and not so much of the, the older history to which I was not, an actual witness. I mean, I have great affection for teachers like Merrill Bradshaw, who is talked about at some length in the Mormon Classics chapter. People like that who were inspiring to me and that I've tried to emulate. On the other hand, I am continually amazed by and intimidated in some ways, as we all must be by our children, I am by my students who are now, in many cases, colleagues, whose mental alertness combined with faithful devotion, it produces some tremendous artwork, and specifically in my field, musical artistry. And so I have, my favorites, and I have new ones from year to year, but I feel so blessed to thus far have been a part of it. I don't know if I should mention this, but I will anyway, and you can always edit it out. But when I joined the church in the confirmation, I was blessed. They said, you will leave your mark on the cultural history of this church. And I was quite stunned by that at the time. And I don't know if individually I've done that. I hope so in some ways. And I hope that the mark is not a flaw, but or a scratch, but a mark in a positive way. But I see that in the people whom I've been able to teach and convey a lot of what I've learned from Mormon musical history, the aspirations and the vision that they had and the determination to really excel at these things. If I've been able to pass that along and what I'm seeing in my students and former students, then they're sort of my favorite people now because they're affirming to me and to the history that I think I'm celebrating in this book.
Very good. We've been discussing Mormonism and Music, a History. This book is by Michael Hicks, BYU music professor, composer, and of course, author. I'm Nathan Wright, and from all of us here at Legacy, thank you, Michael, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.